This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the second hour of the Financial Sense News Hour and part of the program that we call The Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. And in the first hour of the show this week, you heard Ralph Acampora say that he's taken his foot off the pedal a bit regarding the markets and saying that we should proceed with caution. And Jim, you know well that we have discussed at length here that this is one of the most expensive markets in history. And we're now in a rate raising cycle as well. So the element of risk very clearly has gone up. Now the question is, do you get out of the market or do what Ralph said and proceed with caution?
Well, I mean, you know, as we have talked here probably over the last month or two, it's no doubt that stocks are overvalued. But John, that doesn't necessarily mean we'll have a crash. I mean, if you take a look at what we've talked about in the past, where the bubble in the market is, it's really in passive indexing in index funds, which are driving these high valuations that you see so often on some of the stocks we've mentioned here on the program. In fact, Ralph and I talked a little bit about some of these. But the market fundamentals still look good. They're not great, but I'll tell you, it's getting harder and harder to find value for your money. And so what Ralph is saying, he goes, he thinks we're still in a secular bull market, but he says, you know what? I'm taking the foot off the pedal here. Things are getting a little bit on the risk side, and he's probably seen some things technically, as we've been talking about in the first hour with divergences. So whenever you see that, it means there are risks out there and you need to be more self-aware, because a lot of times when risks are out there, they're really not discovered until some big event or something big triggers it in the market. And all of a sudden everybody said, why didn't I see that? And then people panic.
And of course, panic's always fun, but nice to avoid if you can. So Jim, what are the risks?
Well, I mean, it depends on where you look. I mean, we often talk about the Fab Five stocks. I would say, John, is probably where there's the greatest risk. And as we mentioned, indexing by passive investors, that's what's driving these valuations. As we discussed on the program a couple of weeks ago, anytime you put money into a NASDAQ index fund, an S&P index fund, that money automatically goes into the largest cap weightings within the index. So the more money that comes into these index funds, the more money goes into these stocks. And that's why you're seeing elevations and stock prices go the way they have. For example, this week with Amazon touching over $1,000 a share, Google getting up there as well. But the risk is also in bond funds that aren't hedged, because right now we know probably this month, the Fed is probably going to raise interest rates probably for the second time this year. There's a question whether they'll go again in the fall. They're talking about maybe September and December. But we do know whenever you get involved in a Fed rate raising cycle, as Ralph and I talked about in hour one, the old Edson Gould adage about three steps and a stumble. Well, the Fed has already raised interest rates three times. And this month, it'll probably come the fourth time. So the higher interest rates go, the greater the risk. And also, we're in a period of what I think going forward, and we'll get to this in just a moment, where we're going to see lower returns on all investment classes. And this applies equally to the bond market, where we're seeing yields that, John, we haven't seen probably in our lifetime or anybody's lifetime when you're talking about treasuries as low as they are today. And one of the reasons why people have been puzzled with the Fed raising interest rates, why that yield curve hasn't steepened, in other words, longer term rates should be higher. And part of it is the interest rate differential between us and interest rates around the globe. If you look at Europe, interest rates are 1% or less. And if you take a look at here, you can get 2.3% on a 10-year treasury note. So a lot of foreign money is coming into the U.S. simply because there's a yield spread between our sovereign debt and the sovereign debt that you can get, especially in Europe, Japan, and elsewhere.
So high prices and then low yields are, you can see this, making this market a lot riskier. But I'm assuming you're not predicting anything like an imminent crash or something like that.
No, because like I said, I mean, outside some of these Fab Five stocks that are selling at 200 times earnings, which are somewhat crazy, but I, as I explained, it's being driven by these index funds as money pours into index funds, which has become the most popular investment. But outside of index funds, it's really hard to make a case that there's a real bubble. Like, this isn't like what we saw in real estate in the last decade or tech stocks in the 90s, although if we keep going at this rate with some of these tech stocks, although when you look at technology, this is really applying to, I would say, a handful of stocks rather than it is the overall sector. And what we're seeing, as Ralph talked about, is really this bifurcated market that we're seeing right now. You've got people that are going for growth, which is driving technology. But on the other hand, you're seeing sectors that are driven by the search of yield. And the best example is the utility index, as Ralph talked about in hour one. You've got the NASDAQ and the utility index making new record highs, and both reflect different objectives of investors, one seeking yield and the other seeking return.
So if there is no apparent bubble out there, that's eliminated, but we're talking about risk. So where would the risk lie?
Well, I mean, you know, it really depends on what your definition of risk. If you take a look at the academic world defines risk as volatility, things fluctuating or moving in different direction. And the problem is, risk is really, there's a threefold problem when it comes to risk. Number one is understanding what that risk is, whether you're getting into a passive index fund when the stock market is overvalued, or getting into a bond fund, not understanding where that high yield is coming from. So number one is understanding risk. Two is recognizing when the elements of risk are high. And three, if you do understand there's risk out there, how to control it. And really, what happens is risk is largely invisible to those that are invested in the market. Because if it was, a lot of people would have not gotten heavily leveraged into real estate or into tech stocks in 1999 and 2000. The problem is people are very comfortable with consensus. And so as long as the markets are going up, there's nothing really bad on the horizon. You know, people don't see there's any risk out there, and you usually don't. How many people in 2006 or 2005 saw that there was risk in the real estate market? Or if you wanted to go back to 1997 through the year 2000, when technology was going up double digits a year, 70% alone in the year 1999, nobody sees risk because it's good times. People think that whatever is happening currently, you can extrapolate that into the future. And so when you really get down to risk, it's really defining what it is, and recognizing it is really starts when understanding by investors, and you usually see this where they're paying little heed to it. Investors are being optimistic, and they end up paying too much for a given asset as a result. So in other words, high risk comes primarily from high prices. Because if something was low priced, whether it's housing, whether it's a commodity, or whether it's a stock, there's less risk. And so risk really becomes an element of prices. Because whether it's an individual security or an asset that is either overrated or overpriced, or an entire market that has been borne aloft by bullish sentiment or sky-high prices, participating when prices are high rather than shying away is the main source of risk. And risk rises when markets go high. And John, oftentimes people don't see that as risky. They just think, wow, the stock market's going up. It's hitting new records. Things must be going rather well.
So what we're saying here is that risk is an element of price, because if we go back to the frothy housing market, which led us to the crisis back in 2007, or the technology bubble that happened back in the 90s, the risk is that the prices became extremely far out of line with the fundamentals, and people were buying the froth, so to speak, rather than the fundamentals of the instruments they were purchasing.
Yeah, because as I mentioned, investment risk comes primarily from too high prices, and too high prices often comes, John, from excessive optimism. Nobody in 1999 or the year 2000, whatever, or could have foreseen the events that unfolded in the ensuing 2 years, because excessive optimism and inadequate skepticism and risk aversion usually isn't available or isn't prevalent in those kind of market environments. The contributing underlying factors include low prospective returns on safe investments, which is what is driving a lot of risk-taking today. People are just simply searching for yield wherever they can get it, whether it's emerging market debt, high-yield junk bond funds, or long-duration bond funds. And the other thing that they see is good performance by risky assets. In other words, if things that are risky are doing well, things like, for example, you know, Amazon going to $1,000 a share, or Alphabet or Netflix or some of these other stocks, they look at that and say, wow, things are doing very well. People don't see risk in those circumstances. Another thing that you also see in these kind of situations are strong inflows of capital and easy availability of credit. And one of the things that, as we're going to do here shortly in an interview with an economist from Zillow, is we really don't see a lot of cheap credit. In other words, and we're not seeing no-doc loans, liar loans, ninja loans. In the credit markets, lenders have been rather circumspect. Probably the only risk out there is probably in student loans and car loans right now, because those loans have gotten to be subprime, and we're now starting to see defaults.
So if we look at the last 9 years, you know, you could quote Charles Dickens, best of times, worst of times. We're not having any really stellar growth. Look at it. It's what, 2%, maybe a hair less than that. We've had negative growth in some quarters. Now unemployment has come down. That's positive. But people seem to be operating in the idea that things are okay, when in reality, I think, Jim, we're just really getting along.
You know, I talked about first place is there are two things that are very important when you want to control risk. Number one, understanding what that risk is. And number two, recognizing when that risk is high. If you take a look at what we're seeing today, we have elevated price earnings ratios on stocks. We have a narrowing of credit spreads between low quality and high quality debt. You have a lot of undisciplined investors that are just throwing money into passive index funds, thinking, you know what, might as well, you can't beat the market, might as well join the market. You have margin debt, which is at record levels, and you have strong capital inflows. I mean, right now, depending on where you're looking for, and this is why we saw this dichotomy that we're seeing today between the utility index and also the NASDAQ, is you have strong capital inflows that are coming in search of yield. And it's not, John, it's not just individual investors. If you're a pension fund like CalPERS or any kind of state or company pension plan, where are you going to get a rate of return? You know, CalPERS is still assuming a 7% rate of return. And the only way they're going to get that is if they're invested in the stock market, because they certainly aren't getting that in the bond market. And the other thing that you also have to be aware of, risk comes in cycles, and it goes along with the business cycle itself. This economic recovery began in June, or the second quarter of 2009, and here we are in the year 2017. So this recovery is getting along in the tooth, and we also have the Fed raising interest rates. So, you know, what it tells me, John, we may be able to muddle along, but we're going to get into here in just a moment, is the returns going forward for investors, and people aren't going to like to hear me say this, they're going to be much, much lower. And for a lot of people that are getting ready to retire, they're going to end up with a big surprise, as many investors did, that got invested in bond funds in 2008 and 9, only to see those yields drop precipitously over the last 7 or 8 years, and then at times see their bond funds lose money.
And so what I hear you doing, Jim, is you're not painting a doom and gloom picture, but really I'd say one that's more of a realistic one, because as we look at it, the market returns over the next decade are seriously unlikely to be what we've seen during our lifetimes. I mean, the prime example of that is the S&P 500 going nowhere from January of 2000 until April of 2013. But if we look at it from the point of view of investing, where does that present a problem? I mean, theoretically, if you know what's going on, you can still do things, but it's going to leave some investors, what, in the lurch, or at least wondering what to do?
Well, a lot of this, the problems are really created when a lot of people are saving retirement. Let's say you're one of those individuals, you're 5, 10 years away from retirement, or maybe you just retired, John, is most of the planning assumptions that are used in planning software, we don't use it, but they're based on market returns over the last 30 to 100 years. And the problem is when you start using averages over the last 30-year period, which would incorporate, let's say, 10 years in the last decade where the market went nowhere, spectacular returns in the 90s, and spectacular or decent returns in the 80s. Well, if you average those returns over a 30-year period, you come up with this average return that looks good, and people use those assumptions. Other planning software is used on assumptions based on a 100-year market return, which is that 10% figure you hear people use, or let's say 6% for bonds and maybe 3% for treasury bills. The problem, as you just pointed out, from the year 2000, if you were to take returns based on realistic assumptions, for example, the last 17 years, you come up with a far different figure. And the problem we have in the industry, if you go to get your MBA, you get a degree in finance, you're taught about efficient markets, and you're also talking about, well, you can't beat the market, the buy and hold, hence the bubble that we see today in passive indexing funds, and which have, to my mind, have become the real bubble. And if you take a look at this 10% rate of return historically over the last 30 years, where does that rate of return come from? The majority of it has come from earnings growth, which has been a little over 5% a year. A little over 4% has come from dividends, and then almost 1% has come from PE expansion, meaning that in a bull market, as the market goes up, people are willing to pay more and more for a dollar of earnings. So if we take a look at where PE multiples were 4 or 5 years ago, they were reasonably low, in the low teens. Today, they're in the upper teens and some over 20. And of course, we're talking about some of these fab stocks that are selling at 200 times earnings. But if you look at your returns on a rolling 10-year basis, kind of like what the Case-Shiller does on PEs, they take a look at PE averages over a 10-year market period. If you take a look at rates of return over a 10-year period, you come up with much, much different market assumptions. And that's the problem with the financial industry today, is we keep throwing out these average returns that are based on the last 30 years or last 100 years. And if you start to dissect those returns and look at them, John, it tells you a totally different story.
So if we assume that the returns are going forward, obviously, from this point onward, are likely to be much lower, where are you drawing your data for that? What are you basing your assumptions upon?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at these historic returns that everybody talks about, the stock market return of 10%, we just talked about that. But if you take a look at the total return of the market that makes up that 10% number, it comes from three components. Capital gains. Capital gains is a function of two components: earnings per share growth and PE multiple. So as earnings grow and people are willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings, that represents the capital gains portion of your return, which is roughly about 6% out of that 10% rate of return. The other third component is dividend yield. So what happens to these components in a bear market? In a bear market is driven by a recession. In other words, the economy slows down, goes into recession. What happens in a recession? Companies' earnings drop. So earnings per share drops, and also in a recession, PE multiples drop. So the major component, that 6% out of the total 10, goes negative because earnings go negative, PE multiples contract, and that's how you get a downward stock market. About the only thing that remains level, assuming you're in a blue chip company, is dividends. So we're more likely to, going forward, is number one, we're 9 years into this business recovery, and we know sooner or later, the longest we've ever gone is about 10 years without a recession. So sooner or later, we're likely to have a recession, especially with the Fed now raising interest rates. What does that mean? In a recession, earnings are going to drop. Number two, PE multiples are going to fall. So the growth portion of that 10% return, John, is likely to drop, and it's more likely to happen going forward. And the problem is everybody uses these kind of averages when we talk about, you know, especially it's done in the planning industry when people are planning for retirement, they plug in these numbers and these assumptions and they don't hold up. And this was brought up recently on a FSN Insider with Chris Sheridan with Ed Easterling from Crestmont Research.
If you're going to Chicago and you come to me and you say, what's the weather like in Chicago and how should I pack? If I give you the long-term view, I'll tell you, well, it's 65, you know, pack for nice temperate weather. But the reality is, almost all the time in Chicago, it's either hot or cold. It's rarely 65. So, but the first thing I should have said is, well, when are you going? Are you going to be going during a winter period or going during a summer period? And then use an average that relates to the period that you're going to be experiencing or when you're traveling. And investors today are setting out on a 10-year trek to Chicago in the markets. And the key is to recognize that we're starting out not with the aggregate of all of the last 100 years of history, but rather the periods that start with above-average valuations. We're not just above average. We're in the well into the top 10% of valuations, nearly the top 5% of valuations. So it is it's a very high degree of certainty, very high degree of certainty that we are set for well below average returns or worse.
Once again, that was a clip from Ed Easterling from Crestmont Research, and it was during an interview that Chris Sheridan did during our weekday premium channel interviews. So, Jim, as we move forward, when we're looking at risk, what do you see? What should we avoid?
Well, at some point, John, in probably the next couple of years, we're more likely to see a recession. That recession will produce a bear market in stocks. We do know right now that PE multiples on a good segment of stocks are very high. The other thing that we know about returns going forward, if returns are expected to be lower going forward, probably in the 5 to 6% return, dividends are going to play a larger and larger role in total return. One of the things that I do, at least personally, is when I screen for stocks, I look for dividend yields that are 3.5% or more that are growing between 5 and 7% a year. Because at 7%, I know my income is going to double every 10 years. The other thing that we know, the Fed is raising interest rates. So what does that mean? Bonds are at risk. And we also know that we've entered into a long-term structural bear market in bonds. So what are we doing? We're using laddered bonds, and then we're also using a barbell strategy in adjustable rate bonds. So if you're going to be in the bond market, you have to employ a different strategy going forward in a bear market than you did, for example, in a bull market, just as stock investors do the same thing. And going forward, I think, John, when you're going to see these rates of return, where if you look at the next decade, the rate of return overall in the markets, total return is more likely to be anywhere in the 5 to 6% range. Well, if I can get 60% or 70% of that return in the form of a steady income and dividend, I'm going to take that over the prospects of buying stocks that will grow and outpace the economy, as so many people are doing right now, in my opinion, by making the mistake of chasing some of these elevated stocks that are selling at 100, 50, 200 times earnings. I think there's a lot of risk in that market.
And coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour as part of the big picture is an interview with Aaron Terraza. So we're going to look at the real estate market. Is it in a bubble or not? As the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
China has been quite interesting in that they have managed to engineer through stimulus a pretty remarkable rebound. The property market there has been going very strong, and you know, I say for China to get the risk and economic outlook in China, if you only want to look at one indicator, it's property prices. You know, on that front, the indicators that I look at for China's property market, there's one leading indicator that I look at, and that's interest rates. And the way that interest rates have started to move historically, that will flow through into lower housing prices sort of 6 to 12 months everyone talks about there start to actually become real.
Well, the big question today is real estate. Real estate prices have bounced back sharply from their lows during the Great Recession. But in some areas of the country, the price of real estate is becoming almost unaffordable. Are we in another real estate bubble? Joining me on the program is Aaron Terrazas. He's with Zillow. He's one of their chief economists. Aaron, let's begin with real estate in general. I mean, if you look at prices across the country, measured by the Schiller Case Home Index, prices have bounced back rather sharply. I guess the question is right now, are we in another bubble when it comes to the price of real estate?
You know, that's such a kind of a laden question. Bubbles have such an emotional feeling to them. Everyone has these sharp memories of what happened back in 2007, 2008. And I think it's important to step back analytically and look kind of what was really driving that bubble a decade ago. So much of that was driven by lax lending standards, you know, people able to get loans with very little documentation of income, you know, people with relatively low credit scores. So there's a lot of credit risk out there. We're not seeing that kind of lending activity today. So certainly prices are high according to our own Zillow Home Price Index. We're just recovering in April. We regained that pre-crisis peak. In April 2017, we surpassed the April 2007 home value for the first time. So it took us 10 years to build out of that crash, but we're back there now. And prices are certainly high, but it's a very different time than it was 10 years ago. We're not seeing those kind of lax lending standards that we saw in 2004, 2005.
Yeah, there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about FICO scores have really improved. In fact, the average is 700, implying that since it's been, what, 8-9 years since the credit crisis, that people that short sailed their home or got their homes foreclosed on are actually going to be in a situation where their credit is clear. Does this bode well for the real estate market going forward?
There's certainly an enormous amount of demand pent up out there right now for homes to buy. You mentioned kind of this population of former homeowners who lost their homes, took a hit to their credit scores, and are now starting to finally see their credit scores recover back to those purchase quality levels again. You know, some of them may be on the housing market again. But more importantly, I think there is this population of young adults who came of age during the recession years, graduated into a very weak labor market. They're suddenly starting to feel a little bit more better off. You know, the labor market is very tight and they're on the market to buy homes. Our own data suggests that just last year, almost half of homes bought were by kind of the so-called millennials, young adults buying their first home. So certainly some of these boomerang buyers, as we call them, but also a lot of young adults driving the market right now.
You know, another thing I think that has changed as a result of the housing crisis, I think lenders have been stricter in terms of credit applications, what they're looking for, and buyers requiring down payments. Certainly, we're not into ninja or liar loans like we were in the past, Aaron. But let's talk about the availability of credit in terms of banks have been strict. Number two, prices have been high, but they're being driven by an event I wonder if you can comment on. It's not like builders are out there speculating like they did in the last decade, even though there was a report out this week that existing home sales slipped. They said that the spring selling season promises to be one of the most competitive in years, with new buyers entering the market, and demand is easily outstripping supply in most of the country. So let's talk about what is driving some of these prices. They're up over 4.6% or almost 5 or 6% from, a year ago, but the decline in inventory is telling us a lot about where this market is.
That's right. I mean, if you think about what was going on a decade ago, rising prices were driven by very strong demand. People were able to get loans. There were a lot of buyers out there. Today, it's very much of a different situation in that prices are driven by tight supply, relatively few homes on the market. When you look at kind of the fast-growing markets like a Bay Area, like a Seattle, inventory, the number of homes on the market is down, you know, almost 20% in some of those markets over the year. So relatively few homes on the market, as you noted, particularly new homes remain tight. Builders aren't building the same number of homes that they built back in 2004, 2005. At the same time, as we noted, there are that pool of buyers who are all competing for that relatively limited pool of available homes to buy.
And what do you think is holding builders back? Is it regulation? Is it building permits and getting that approved? I know here in Southern California, it's very tough to get building permits. The time frame for getting a permit can be rather extensive. With strong demand, with credit out there, with interest rates at some of the lowest levels that we've seen in centuries. In fact, I think one thing about the interest rate market today that I think you would agree, Aaron, is unlike sort of the sucker loans that we had in the last decade, I mean, you can actually get a 15-year mortgage or a 30-year mortgage at a relatively low level today, which seems like it would make it easier to get a home financed.
That's certainly right. Interest rates are very low. And despite moves by the Federal Reserve to hike interest rates, long-term interest rates such as mortgage rates kind of keep staying down. When you talk to home buyers, first and foremost in their mind is the difficulty in saving for a down payment. Coming up with that down payment, particularly as home prices rise, is the biggest challenge that home buyers of all ages are facing. Now, to get back to your question about home builders and why they aren't building, you know, you talk to home builders across the country, and you mentioned some of the factors that they tend to cite. It's really all of the above. It's kind of a death by a thousand cuts in some respect. They talk about the land, labor, and capital are all increasingly difficult to find. The prime lots to develop, particularly large lots where they can develop a large number of homes, are scarce. Labor is a concern for a lot of number of builders. The labor market, as we know, is very tight. Unemployment rate is kind of essentially at as low as it's going to get. And then capital, getting financing, particularly for development loans, construction development loans, has been particularly difficult over the past couple of years as some of the regulations around bank capital requirements have shifted.
I have a client who's a custom home builder and contractor, and he said one of the difficulties he has right now, and especially on several of his projects, is getting enough skilled labor, because with the Great Recession and the downturn in real estate, there were simply a lot of people that just simply left the construction business, went elsewhere, and sometimes, you know, delays in getting a home built are based on the fact that he can't get, I don't care if it's electrician, a house framer, concrete work, whatever it is, there's delays because of lack of workers.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that so many of these workers involved in home building are actually very skilled tradesmen, and our education system, particularly our vocational training system, isn't training the workers who have those skills, as you say, an electrician or plumbing or framing. Those are very kind of specific skills that take years to develop.
I guess also with the decline of union membership, you used to have, at least I know, decades ago, you would join a union and you would go through this skill building program like an apprentice. And as you advanced and as you got more experience, you were really being trained on the job. There's nothing like that. You know, most parents want their kids to go to school, which is another reason why there's a dearth of skilled workers out there.
Absolutely true. You know, the kind of young adults today, for the most part, are going into kind of more office jobs than skilled trades.
So when you look at the real estate market, are you finding pockets, let's say certain cities, and, you know, the Bay Area comes to mind when you look at some of the prices up there. I have clients that live up there, and they're just absolutely blown away in terms of what prices of homes are going for. Do you find that there are certain pockets in the country that you would describe as, let's say, overpriced? I don't want to use the word bubble, because bubble would imply the entire market. But are there areas, in your opinion, that have bubble-like prices?
Yeah, I think you noted all of the expensive markets where we do see affordability, you know, the share of kind of the typical income that goes to a mortgage payment at historic lows. The Bay Area certainly tops most of those lists, both San Francisco and San Jose. I think there are concerns about parts of Los Angeles and San Diego as well, where prices are also very high. And, you know, when you look at historical price-to-income ratios, those levels are also very high. So, yes, you know, I think the Bay Area is not affordable right now. Prices are very high, and we are starting to see prices flatten out, particularly in San Jose.
And are there any areas that, in your opinion, haven't fully recovered? I know some of the hot spots of overvaluation during the housing bubble, California was definitely one of them, Arizona, Vegas, and even parts of Florida. Are there any areas like that that were depressed as a result of the housing crisis that have yet to come back?
Large swaths of the country are still feeling the scars of the bust. While most California markets are well above their pre-crisis levels, in places like Las Vegas, in Phoenix, in Orlando, home values are still as much as 20% below their pre-crisis peak still. So those communities still have a long way to recover. And some research from some of our colleagues recently showed that I think two-thirds of the nation's homes are actually still below their pre-crisis peak. So the hot housing markets are very strong and well above their pre-crisis peaks, but there's large swaths of America that are still well below where they were in 2005, 2006.
And are you seeing any changes in terms of preferences in the building market, in terms of the buyers that are coming in this market? Would you say they're first-time buyers? I know when the market began to take off in 2012, it was a lot of investors who were coming back into the market. But the younger generation, especially the millennials and new, let's say, startup families have been absent when this market took off. Are you seeing that change now? In other words, millennials coming into the market, new household formations that drive this demand for housing?
We are. Starting really last year, where we saw millennials come onto the market in large numbers, we think in 2016 and certainly continuing through 2017, millennials are driving the bulk of home purchases. And for the most part, you know, these are young adults who have rented for much longer than their parents' generation, but they are looking for similar types of homes. You know, we survey millennials and ask them what types of homes they're looking for, and overwhelmingly, they want your classic kind of suburban single-family home. They're also conscious of their commutes and prefer something, you know, closer to the employment cores, but often that's kind of a little too pricey for them at this point.
You know, one of the changes that we've seen in Southern California, and especially downtown, is a revitalization of the area. San Diego's downtown skyline is filled with all these high-rise condo complexes. A lot of them lawyers that like to work downtown near the courthouses. Are you seeing a change in terms of the composition of housing sales? I know here in San Diego, you're seeing these downtown high-rises, or is suburbia still the place to be because of the cheapness of the land and the cost of housing?
I think suburbia is still the dominant place where people look to buy homes. The reality is, particularly in those pricey markets, affordability is a concern for first-time buyers. And more importantly than that, they want a place where they feel comfortable raising a family, you know, yards, schools, and all those things that people typically look for when they're looking to buy a house. That said, I do think there is some truth to this idea that there has been a resurgence in urban cores and urban living. You know, perhaps some of it is driven by baby boomers downsizing, young adults renting for longer. So there's a little truth to both the urban renewal and kind of the continuation of suburbia.
And let's talk about another sector of the market. Here in California, rents keep going up. It's very difficult to get multi-tenant housing today approved. There's just not a lot of land available in places like San Diego. Are you seeing any changes in terms of multifamily housing? Does that still represent a good value or proposition for, let's say, investing?
So much of the multifamily housing value proposition right now really depends on the details of the project. In parts of the country, we have seen an enormous amount of investment in apartments and apartment building. You see it in San Francisco particularly, and you know, to a certain degree in Los Angeles. And the assumptions that go into those buildings, I think, really matters as far as commercial real estate goes. And we are starting to see apartment rents flatten in places like San Francisco. Of course, flatten at very, very high levels. That's important to keep in mind. But, you know, supply and demand ultimately, sooner or later, catch up with each other. And we're starting to see that in the apartment market in the Bay Area.
And if you were looking for a bubble in terms of what we saw, let's say, in the last decade, what would be the signs that you would be looking for, Aaron? I know we talked about certain areas like Northern California, especially California. I don't care if you're looking at San Diego, Los Angeles, or San Francisco that tend to be extremely overpriced. What other things would you look for? Because certainly you cannot say this is a national trend.
certainly not. I think California is very much an outlier right now. You could perhaps group it with some of the other big West Coast markets like Seattle or Portland, which for the most part are still much more affordable than any part of coastal California. But as far as what I'm looking for, as far as a future bubble, for me, lending standards is really the red flag. Once you start to see loans being made to people who can't service those loans, or you don't know whether or not they can service those loans, that's when I'll begin to get worried. And the reality is we're not seeing that right now. I think there are some concerns out there about, you know, whether the minimum credit score is still too high. Increasingly, banks are offering lower down payment options. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have recently done some changes to make it easier for households to handle student debt burdens, which, you know, is very important, particularly for first-time buyers and young adults. But for the most part, lending standards are relatively prudent. If we begin to see a substantial easing, for me, that's a big red flag.
And finally, if there's any areas that you think offer great value in terms of home ownership, because we're seeing a lot more migration now with the improvement in the job market. One of the problems that limited migration was a lot of homeowners, for example, were upside down in their mortgages. That's not the case today. Are there any areas of the country that you think represent great values from what you guys follow?
You know, you look for places with both strong job growth and still relatively affordable housing. For me, kind of those promising markets are places like Dallas, Texas, or Denver, to some degree Phoenix, and perhaps, you know, parts of Central Florida, Dallas and Tampa, perhaps some of the Carolinas like Charlotte and the Research Triangle. Those are the places where you still see strong job growth and relatively cheap housing.
Well, listen, Aaron, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. If our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how can they do so, please?
We encourage people to check out our research website. That's zillow.com/research. We have all sorts of research up there and data that people can download if they're interested in digging into the numbers themselves. All of our data are available for free on our website.
Well, this week with President Trump saying we were going to back out at least temporarily from some of the commitments in the climate agreement, it's interesting to see how that affects the politics of everything. These are interesting times in which we live. What are we looking at in the weeks coming?
So in the weeks ahead, we're going to be looking at the economic numbers, especially as this is the month of June. So this will end officially the second quarter. So we got two things coming up. We're going to have earnings warnings, which we normally get just before the quarter closes, usually a couple weeks before. If anybody's going to miss their projections, you want to get that news out. And then also, we've got the Fed FOMC meeting this time, widely anticipated. The Fed will raise interest rates for the second time this year. And also, the meeting will be accompanied by a press conference. So they're going to be looking for clues. Does the Fed still project raising interest rates going forward into the end of the year? And then also, any important evidence about what the Fed intends to do, as they've made mention in previous meetings, of unwinding their balance sheet, which could be another form of tightening. All that coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.